How is it that we find ourselves surrounded by such complexity, such elegance?
The genes of you and me,
the genes of you and me,
we're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA. We're all made of DNA.
Hi, you're listening to DNA Today, a multi-award-winning podcast and radio show where we discover new advances in the world of genetics. From genetic technology like CRISPR to rare diseases to new research, for over a decade, DNA Today has brought you the voices of leaders in genetics in over 200 episodes. For the past 3 years, DNA Today has won the People's Choice Best Science and Medicine Podcast Award. I'm Kira Dineen. I'm a certified genetic counselor and your host. Our most streamed episode of 2023 last year was not shockingly about artificial intelligence. I think a lot of podcasts would agree with that if they had an episode about AI. So in this episode, the founder of Genobank.io, Daniel Irby, and I talked about how AI can and will impact genetics. So for those that haven't checked out that episode, it's number 231. We'll also have a link in the show notes for you. That episode was recorded in February 2023 and came out shortly after. So, of course, so much has changed in AI and how we're able to use AI. It's everywhere. And since this show is about genetics, we're obviously focused on how AI can be used in genetics. And I want to learn today about how AI can be used to sort through variants to figure out which are pathogenic, which are causative for symptoms. So, of course, I was like, well, why don't we have Daniel come back on the show to dive into this? Because your episode, again, was the most streamed episode of 2023. So thank you so much for coming back on.
Oh, my God. No, thank you very much. It was a surprise, obviously, when you announced the data about how that specific episode was so popular. I mean, I feel grateful and honored. I think, as you were saying, the topic is, to be honest, the one that is hot. I am not saying we are not one of the voices around it, but the topic is super hot because it's literally changing how we consume and we interact with our computers. Like now, when I was a kid, I really believed that a computer was going to be able to just type any question and give it to me. Literally, this is 1984 with my first Apple IIe, right? But now we have it. Now it's here. Now you have AIs that will help you on every aspect of human lives or almost, right? So thank you very much for the opportunity here. It's always a pleasure to be here and be with your audience again.
Yeah. And you're the guy to have on the show for this conversation because, again, you're the founder and CEO of Genobank.io, which is at the forefront of integrating AI with genomics to empower individuals and families and understanding their health and DNA. And you also have this great background in data science, AI, and bioinformatics. So can't, you know, imagine a more perfect guest. And because, you know, again, you were the most streamed episode of last year, according to Spotify and other sources. So, you know, had to continue the conversation. So since it's been a bit over a year since we recorded that episode, again, episode 231, for people that want to go back and listen and hear how little I knew about AI at the time, I get to redeem myself now. What are some highlights of what's changed in the past year plus with how far AI has come, you know, especially thinking about it in the genomic scope?
Of course. So there's been, as you were saying, a lot of progress. I would call it progress, even if there now that progress are some restrictions now as well. Again, just moving in the right direction. So last year, we as a company, we just built a prototype where, like, individuals or families, again, not only will be able to tokenize, and again, the tokenization process is like putting a deed kind of stamp in the blockchain about who is the owner or who is the donor, or there are a lot of names, but that's always been the center of this project. Like, hey, let's first of all, explain who provided this biosample, which laboratory processed it, what is the quality and the metadata or the characteristics of the files that has been delivered by the laboratory. Let's put it against fraud, like nobody can tamper it after that because the laboratories cryptographically signed this data set. But then with this emerging AI, the last year we were talking about how we can give now utility to this very secured and now family-owned vaults or individually owned vaults of data, right? Because now we're transitioning to a more, let's say, decentralized ways of holding your own genome, right? It's not in the database anymore of a company. It's within your, storage, right? Or personal storage. That's still the same, but now is how we can give you the utility. So how we can connect it to the AI was solved last year. But then how can you create a social graph, right, with the professionals around this data? Because it will never be enough, in my opinion, to just have an AI trying to help you navigate your DNA data. They're really good, and we'll talk about a little bit further. But now is let's complete the ecosystem, because we will still need, obviously, the human that is certified, that has the credentials, that has the experience to give the diagnosis. So what I'm trying to say is, like, we went from, okay, let's have a secure vault to hold my data, then wielding an API or connectors to talk to humans and machines like AIs. And then is how can I put this in the best context or the best possible context for my case? And my case could be rare blood diseases, could be cancer, could be just ancestry, if I may, or genealogy, whatever that context might be. Then the social connections now are relevant. And that has changed a lot, because then in the terms of legal frameworks, you go from data laws to more liquid ones, right? In terms of, okay, who can access and what is the purpose? And then also you have to solve the payment rails. Right, because now is a layer of services on top of your data. I think I went through a lot, but that's literally is from last year to this year that changed a lot.
Yeah, the framework has really changed, and I think the way you're describing it too is that you're setting up all of these tools basically to use, and from other conversations we've had, we both don't see AI necessarily replacing jobs, but more being a tool. And people in genetics are going to need to learn how to use these tools. Otherwise, they themselves will not be able to perform their jobs the way other people can. So I think that's something that even years ago when chatbots were a really big conversation in genetic counseling, oh, will chatbots replace clinical genetic counselors? No, but can we use that as a tool to kind of streamline, to use chatbots to answer patient questions so that they have a lot more information when they head into a session to be like, oh, I know a little bit more. Now I can ask more, or have the conversation be more about, well, how about me and my life, and more of the counseling piece too. So I think that's kind of a topic that ends up coming up a lot. I think especially in genetic counseling, people are worried about jobs. The job market is really tough right now as it is. So it's scary to think about, you know, could it be further impacted in a negative way? But kind of getting a little bit more into this idea of using AI to kind of comb through genetic information, yep, to prioritize, hey, you should look at these variants before others, because we think, we being the AI robots, think that certain variants are more likely to be causing the disease that we're looking into. So how does AI even begin to do this? Like, how can it enhance the efficiency in this process? Because on the bioinformatics side, I mean, it's a lot of information, especially if we're looking at, we're doing whole genome or whole exome. That is just a mind-boggling amount of information. How do you even begin to do this? Because so far, obviously we're using computers, but it's been human-led, but we're going to transition at some point to be like, AI is going to be a tool in processing all of these variants and helping us prioritize. So how does that even work? Because I use AI, but not in this sense.
Right. Now I think this is the core of the conversations. We were talking about this. So the first thing you mentioned is, yes, I don't see that AIs like taking the roles of genetic counselors by all means. What is really going to happen, I think, is genetic counselors, genetists that learn how to leverage AI will outperform people who or professionals that don't. That is literally, and it's just basic logic, because as humans, we are very intelligent beings, right? Very emotional capable, but we are slow. We are inefficient. So maybe today you can see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 patients a day. With AI, you'll be able to maybe multiply that for 2, 3, factor of 3 or 4, right? And you will reduce, without sacrificing efficiency and accuracy, your your capacity, your human capacity. I don't know, obviously, the what would be the correct balance, right? That'll be. But what I'm trying to say, like literally, a data-driven genetic counselor will be better or more desirable than the one that is not data-driven. So that's what I'm trying to manifest here. The second thing is how really, I mean, getting down to the process is, yes, today it doesn't have any sense just connecting a FASTQ file to the AI, right? That actually the first thing will say, okay, this is an 8 gigabyte file. I cannot interpret nothing. Like, this is a FASTQ file. What do you want to do with it, right? No. But when you go down to the bioinformatic pipeline, you go to the BCF, right? The variant calling file. From there, you annotate the data. And usually a human will tell you, okay, let's just annotate it with maybe 2 or 3 references, let's say CleanBar or DBSNPs or, you know, like CleanGen or one of these, right? And said, and that's pretty enough, because then it becomes really big and I will not be able to. So today we are annotating the BCFs with 72 databases. 72, exactly.
A human cannot look at 72 databases to comb through that.
That's wow. Exactly right. But an AI can, right? An AI can. And so again, is how you design how the AI is digesting the variants. Obviously, it's a hybrid model today. Is not fully automated, at least not in Genovine. But what I'm trying to tell you is conversational, again, is getting down the funnel. It's a funnel of variants that you say, hey, let's filter, like as you were saying, let's start with one score. Let's start with only damaging. Let's start with the missense variants. Let's start with, you know, some criteria that has to come with somebody that knows kind of the field, right? And then the machine will also try to guide you, because it says, okay, the only phenotype that we have from the patient is epilepsy or seizures. Okay, that's good enough. So let's start building that. So this is a real case. A patient for many years didn't know what was going on. I mean, this is very typical. The neurologist and everything's pediatric patient, 11 years old. And for 11 years, the parents were clueless. Like, the best neurologist didn't know what happened until we did the exome and we started conversating with the AI and saying, okay. And to make the long story short, we went down to one damaging pathogenic variant in the SCN1A gene, right? And this gene is obviously responsible of regulating the sodium, right? And it's a sodium channel regulator.
Which is what we hear a lot for seizures, disorders. Yeah, so that makes sense.
Correct. That's exactly what you were describing. Is not telling you what to do. Is telling you that how to differentiate the noisy variants from the sound. Right? Is as you were saying. It saves you time because eventually every single genetics, every single would have gone probably to the same variant in the gene. That's for sure. But the amount of time we took, it was like maybe an hour.
Wow.
Exactly. From the exome to saying, okay, let's do that. Maybe two, right? But as far as I know, some of these analyses maybe will take 4-5 days. I don't know. I mean, it's the times will vary and say, no, he's talking nuts or whatever. But
case by case, yeah.
What I'm trying to tell you, like, exactly. You could say then the report and then go to the other and all other. So a person, a human, an expert now can multiply the benefit or the interactions that they have because there's a big list of families waiting for this type of data interpretation to arrive and then see if there is an actionable item to improve health or I don't know, whatever the outcome might be. But this is the state of the art today. Obviously, the main objective of our company and other companies working in the same is to automate, like trying to get to the sound or the clinical relevant variants as fast as possible. So we can even save lives because in the newborn space, for the newborns, some of these answers to these specific questions save lives, and that's have been proven by, for instance, the Rady's Children's Hospital in San Diego, right? That's
yes.
That's a very inspirational use case that it was documented there. So that's kind of the scenario. But now is fascinating how these AIs are helping us to be better.
And it really helps to just be like, hey, we're using all of these different databases to comb through all of this information that would take a human so long, but combing through and basically the AI being like, hey, here's a suggestion on where to start. What's the most likely variant that could be leading to the symptoms that we're seeing in this patient? And I mean, that is just remarkable in itself. Do you anticipate costs to increase or decrease as we start using AI in our workflow? Because in order to pay for these tools, there's a cost there. But then looking at, all right, well, how much time are we saving? But then do we need to be paying for all of this data? Like, so there's so many different considerations. But what do you see in the short term in terms of costs, but then also the long term?
I think this is a very interesting, I think the economies of, or the economy efficiencies is a question of that regard. So AI in some of the talks I gave, like in general for the human is literally turning around the profitability of some digital process. So one of them is bioinformatics. So what I'm telling you is like usually bioinformatics was a sunk cost. It is very heavy in terms of computational cost and so on and so forth. So machine learning, like tools like Clara, Parabricks from NVIDIA will, I mean, the first exome I use or try to look for the variant calling process took 38 hours. Right, in a typical machine. With NVIDIA, it's only 7 minutes, 7 or 8 minutes.
Wow, that is a huge difference.
Totally. Exome, same laboratory, huge difference, right? So how many 7 minute, you know, now windows can you know?
Right,
you
multiply that by all the patients that would be affected by that.
Exactly.
Yes.
So basically what I'm trying to showcase is it was a super inefficient process, and then by applying machine learning, not LLMs here, it's machine learning just like a predecessor for LLMs, but
language learning models, right? Did I get that right in terms of the acronym? Yeah.
It's the same principle, which is basically the deep variant from Google, right? So it's just a changing by changing that. So again, obviously the economics behind it, if it costs for you 4 units, now it will cost you a fraction of that, like maybe 0.4, right? I don't know. I'm just speaking. But then if your business relied on being very efficient, now not only you can have more patients, you can be more profitable and therefore more sustainable. And so the consequence is that now we will have more data, not only more data, but more accurate data, more curated by AI. We will be able to tackle faster the hallucinations because you will have more reference and so on and so forth. So I think this is literally, I'm super excited because it's a very exciting times to live. Because in the end, all the ecosystem, if you ask everybody, like the from the people who extract the biosamples, the phlebotomists, from all the chain, right, from the biosamples, biobanks, sequencing lab, until you get to the physician, everybody really wants to save lives, to improve lives, to say, I want you to get answers so you can get a precision therapeutic or precision or whatever, right? Something that we know will help you. And that's really getting much, much better because of AI. And I think that's the most exciting part.
It is. Like, that's the reason, like, you know, even I'm doing the show, right? It's so that I can educate people and people can learn. And then, you know, so anybody that's working in the field of genetics, healthcare, science, it's all so that we can improve humans' lives. Like, that is the point. That's why we do what we do. And I want to kind of dive a little bit deeper into talking about data. So, you know, we talked, I'm sure on our episode, about just, you know, how important the data sets that you have are. And I dived into a lot with another previous guest, Rob Biscacci, in episode 269. We'll link that in the show notes as well. Just about when you have these language learning models and all of this and AI, whatever data you're giving it is so important because that's what it's basing off of. That's what it's able to process.
Yeah.
And we have this major problem in genetics, which is slowly getting better, but not fast enough where, and I know for people that listen a lot, I say this a lot, but it's really important, especially in AI, that a lot of the genetic information we have is from people of recent European ancestry. Mm. And it does not represent the human population in the world. So I think that's something that is this going to create even further disparities? Because if we load in, all right, we have someone that has an undiagnosed disease, we're trying to diagnose it, we're thinking it's probably rare and it's probably genetic, and they have kind of these generic symptoms, like you talked about, maybe seizures, developmental delay, failure to thrive, these really general findings. We're like, that could be so many things, right? We load this into the system. The data that it has, if that person is not of recent European ancestry, is it going to miss the variants that are there because maybe it's not present in European genomes? So are we going to have this disparities bigger because of AI, or is it going to be pretty similar to what we've had?
So yeah, the problem today, I think, is very real, right?
Yeah.
And you're totally right. What I think it happened, hopefully, I mean, maybe this is wishful thinking, but I'll try to back up with data. I think AI will help us to describe the problem even better, right? It's going to be a catalyzer of how badly we have been doing diversity on genomics, like saying, because AIs are hungry for data, right? Obviously. And it'll come a time, and every day is a good time to see which data sets have you been training. And this is where the regulations comes in, just the AI Act was just signed a couple of weeks ago. And this is one of the most important topics there.
Wow. Okay. So tell me a little bit more about this act, because I have no idea.
Okay. So there is this is the first kind of regional effort. It's like the GDPR for AI, right? And it basically englobes all the situations. So it's basically the first things is to categorize them as high risk, like the highest risk is like, no, you're not doing this because this is a state label kind of thing, like maybe designing bioweapons, right? So that obviously will never be commercialized, right?
Let's hope, yeah.
Exactly. Then the high risk obviously is those that can affect the individuals like in their lives. And obviously this is the category of medicine, clinical advice, and so on and so forth. So that's very high risk. Or financial advice, you know, all these. Then are the medium and the, you know, the very like not of concern. That's one of the framework, the important frameworks. The other one is obviously the data provenance one, right? Is show me that the data that you, the data sets that you use are properly legal or legalized, right? Show me the permissions, show me the licensing, show me the consents, right? And this again is Genobank here is, I think we are in the right track because our tokens, that is exactly what it means. A consent NFT or a consent token for each of the biosamples. So you can prove for to the regulator that all the data sets that you have that have been used have proper consent in real time. And this is also machine readable. So the AI can also go there and verify this into the blockchain because it's a native kind of conversation. It's not a paper, right? Humans can read paper. I mean, machines as well, but it's kind of difficult and there's a lot of frictions there. But if I can just go to the blockchain and verify the legality of the data sets, then boom, you will have even AIs for regulators. Regulators will also use AI to regulate other AIs. So that's because it's an amazing amount of information now. So humans will not obviously be capable of doing that. But again, back to the AI regulation. So those type of questions you will have to be answered, like how is your diversity? Are you really a mosaic, or are you really representing the population in the good in a good way? So like for instance, the United States, are you really using at least 17% of Latinos? Are you really using
I don't think we are. Listeners, yeah. Please send me articles and different research papers to read, but I would say our databases probably aren't 17%, you know, Hispanic origin. It's just, yeah. Yeah.
But yes, I think that's where the regulators will have to become very handy. Not forcing, but obviously is like you cannot regulate what people don't use. So AI has been used, and then the regulation begins. But we are very, very at the beginning. But I think it again, AI was a catalyzer because otherwise it'll be taking years to convince companies to allow regulator to go into their databases and start like making audits on the diversity of their data sets. Should have not happened for the next 10 years without AI.
Right.
I think.
Yeah, I think that's such an important aspect. And I think we will get to the point sooner rather than later where labs that are doing genetic testing and variant curation, we'll get to a point where all the labs are using AI tools to help them do this. And if you're not, then it's like going to be like, what do you mean you're not doing that? Like, that's not standard in our industry. And I wonder what year that will happen, but it's certainly going to be exciting when we get to this point. Anything you want to leave people with? I can't believe we're already ending the episode. I'm like, oh my God, there's just so much to talk about with AI and genomics. And, you know, you've become like our AI correspondent, I think, for the show. So Daniel, I mean, what do you want to leave people with in terms of just using AI and genomics. I know we spent a lot of time talking about variant curation because that's what I really wanted to focus on, because I think that's going to be the biggest impact in genomics in the short term. But any other thoughts or anything?
Well, again, just to thank you and leave the message that to give opportunity to be optimistic about AI. Yeah, we are in a very, we are in the dawn of this genomics and AI for variant interpretation. But it's really, if you had a conception 3 months ago, it is no longer there.
No.
I mean, this is changing really, really fast. As a company, we just are just trying a new company that is just released, Claude 3 Opus. And it's really, really good, right? And we didn't know about this company like 2 or 3 months ago. And they just raised $2 billion, right? So it's like, and the amount of investment will just only be bigger and bigger. So just give the opportunity in the space. Let's try to be more open. That's what I said, because here is the future. And I think the system, I dare to say that we will see that kind of system in this decade. Like before 2030, we will have these conversations about, okay, this is your variant report, but what did the AI said?
Yes.
Whatever the AI will deliver, the hospitals, whatever. And it'll become a reference for sure.
It really will. Yeah. And how exciting for you to have a company that's in this intersection right as it's starting. I mean, I'm a little jealous. I think it's very, very exciting, Danielle. But thank you so much for coming on and just diving into all this with me. There is so much more to come. And I really want people to check you out, especially labs that are like, hey, we got to start doing this and learning about it and exploring it. Genobank.io, link in the show notes as well. But thank you so much, Danielle.
Thank you very much, Kira. Pleasure to be here.
For more information about today's episode, visit dnatoday.com, where you can also stream all 200 plus episodes of the show, including video versions of interviews recorded in 2021 or later. Any questions, episode ideas, guest pitches, or sponsor inquiries can be sent into info@dnatoday.com. Be sure to follow us on social media, especially so you don't miss a giveaway. We are at DNA Today Podcast on Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, Facebook, and more. Please rate and review the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen. This truly helps us climb the charts and allow more genetic nerds like yourself to find the show. Here's a bonus. If you do and send us a screenshot, I'll give you a shout out on the show. DNA Today is created, hosted, and produced by myself, Kira Dineen. Our team includes communications lead, Corinne Merlino, video lead, Amanda Andrioli, outreach intern, Sonia Tanaker, social media intern, Kajal Patel, and graphic designer, Ashlyn Anokian. Thanks for listening, and join us next time to discover new advances in the world of genetics.
The genes of you and me, the genes of you and me, we're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA.